from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Hey, are you loud feminist? This little light of mine, let's hear you. I'm gonna let it shine.
It's never too late to give women the right they should be due under the United States Constitution.
There's still today countless common sense laws that we have that distinguish differences between men and women. So, for example, do we really want to put our prison populations together with men and women?
And looking at the entire spending plan, we are very concerned that it is not likely to be balanced and that it may end up costing considerably more than the total $1.8 billion in aggressive assumptions.
Is it not a foreseeable result of doing this that people in Danville and other places may see a higher property tax, the very thing that you say is driving people out of the state?
I don't know that it necessarily follows.
Would you at least acknowledge that it's likely that most districts would see a property tax increase as a way to pay those increased costs?
No.
Some of the sounds of this week, Illinois lawmakers inching closer to the scheduled adjournment of the spring session. That's at the end of the month. Can a budget get done in that time? And what about the Equal Rights Amendment? Will it be called for a House vote? We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, joined in studio by Charlie Wheeler. Charlie is the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter, and Rachel Otwell joining us. She's a reporter for NPR Illinois. She covered the Equal Rights Amendment, the rallies that were taking place this week for that. And Rachel, it's good to have you on. Can you tell us where this issue stands at this point?
Sure. So it's a perennial issue that's more so in the news now than ever since my time reporting over the last just, you know, several years. And right now it's made a resolution has made its way through the Senate and is stalled at the moment as supporters of the ERA seek to gain enough votes.
And the House has been where the problem has been, at least the last few times this has gone. They've gone through the Senate before. It was approved a couple of years ago, stalled in the House.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And actually right now, Stephen Anderson, a Republican from Geneva, is working at getting votes together. He says the main opposition is saying that they're worried about permanently legalizing abortion or fears over bathrooms becoming gender neutral, that becoming the law of the land. So, and that kind of narrative has been pushed by groups like the Illinois Family Institute, for instance.
Now, so there is some Republican support for this, Brian.
There is. And I mean, Steve Anderson is on his way out of the legislature. You might remember him as one of the ringleaders of the small group of Republicans who helped Democrats to finally end the two-year budget impasse last year. He has often been willing to go his own way on issues when he disagrees, with, you know, the majority view in his party. And, you know, Charlie can speak to the history of this. The ERA has always made some interesting bedfellows, I think, in who supports it, who doesn't. And, you know, something that's important maybe for some of our younger listeners who weren't around in the early 80s covering the legislature, as I was not. But, I mean, this has been an issue that goes back a long time. And there are questions, and I know, Rachel, you've spent a lot of time covering this, about whether if the Illinois legislature, you know, if Illinois actually does finally ratify this amendment, we've passed the federal deadline set by Congress for states to ratify it. There's still another state that would need to ratify it. There are other states who have rescinded their ratification. So it's not clear that – I mean, this is not like the final piece of the puzzle before this would become, you know, part of the U.S. Constitution.
And Charlie, as Brian was mentioning, this has brought some different coalitions together in the past.
I think it's interesting. We hear the Republicans talk about all the bad things that are going to happen. Back in the day, one of the original co-sponsors of the resolution to ratify this amendment was a female legislator from DuPage County named Giddy Dyer. She and another woman legislator, Jeannie Chapman from Arlington Heights, a Democrat, co-sponsored the resolution. They tried to carry it through the House back in the 70s without much success. There was a lot of what I would consider misrepresentation about what this was going to cause. And as a matter of fact, some of the arguments that we're hearing today are the same arguments that I heard 45 years ago.
Well, and some of those arguments, Shirley, those go to things like, you know, women in combat, some of these issues that
yeah, well, guess what? We already have right. women in combat.
So some things have changed through the time, but I guess that goes back, Rachel, to whether or not what is it accomplished by doing it? Because there are a lot of laws now that give women more access. So would it be, you know, would it accomplish what people want to see with this?
So supporters say in Illinois, as Mackey noted, it's already in the state constitution. They're worried about the federal law of the land, and they say the ERA would elevate sex classification to the same scrutiny that's used for things like national origin and race and ethnicity.
And so that is the concern they still bring up. And you had a chance to talk with somebody who is a relative, a daughter of Phyllis Schlafly, who led this fight against the ERA back in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, so Anne Schlafly Corey is now chair of the Eagle Forum, which was started back in around the same time, I think in the 70s, that the ERA passed through Congress, and this was an issue. They call themselves a family rights group, which basically one of their main focuses is on abortion. But she is lobbying much in the same way that her mother did all those years ago. And Phyllis Schlafly made Illinois her battleground state. She lived here at the time. Anne said, you know, she went to the Capitol multiple times with her mother over this issue. Legislators were, or not lobbyists, were the ones baking pies for legislators, kind of just trying to promote the idea of, you know, a good home life and, you know, if women were to enter the workforce, et cetera, more so that would be bad for family units. But Anne Schlafly Corey brought up that the draft thing that her mother had pushed, she brought that up saying that there would have to be exact equal numbers of women as men in the military, for instance, which, you know, that's quite debatable. And again, I think abortion is really a sticking point here for those.
Yeah,
who are
and I would
it.
Say this idea that, well, there's got to be the same number as men as women. Are there the same number of people of color in the military as there are Caucasians?
Right.
Because if it's a question of being treated equal, as you said, this says you can't discriminate based on somebody's gender. Well, we now say you can't discriminate based on race, but that doesn't mean that there's absolute parity, right?
Well, can somebody tell me why this is getting so much attention now? Because certainly this has been a fight that's been going on. Some people have been waging this battle for decades. Why right now? Why does it seem to be picking up so much steam right now?
I think in the wake of the Me Too movement, there's a lot of analysis I've read that kind of chalks it up to that. Our president is someone who has made disparaging comments against women. So people who maybe thought this was already part of our Constitution, especially people who are maybe 30 years old and younger, you know, have been – some people are appalled to know that it's not already part of the Constitution. So I think kind of this sea change that we're noticing when it comes to women's issues and just more openly addressing problems in our society, the ERA is kind of – you know, it's gained some steam due to those efforts.
And I think you also can't ignore the state political angle here. We saw this week people trying to pressure Governor Rauner to take a stand on this issue. J.B. Pritzker appeared at a rally this week, the Democratic candidate. So this is another way in which Democrats are you know, the governor has tried over the years to appeal to moderate voters, to women who maybe are support abortion rights. I mean, he famously drew himself a primary opponent by signing a bill that expanded abortion access in this state and helped public funding of abortion. And so I think Democrats are saying, like, you know, see this as an opportunity to try and put the governor on the spot and pin him down, even though he doesn't really have a formal role in the ratification process. This is just something that, you know, they hope people will keep asking him about.
And meanwhile, Personal PAC has asked the candidates for Governor Pritzker and Rauner to sign a pledge saying that they will uphold the state health insurance and Medicaid expansion for abortion access. So I think it's related.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to watch that. There could be a vote possibly as early as this coming week, right?
They said it could have been this week. Obviously, that didn't happen. So it appears they're struggling to get the votes. So we'll see.
Well, something else they're always struggling to do is get a budget in place. And Brian Mackey, we're waiting to see if they can get one done on time for the first time in what seems like several years now. They'd like to try to do that, I guess, by the end of May, but there still seems to be some disagreement and some distance between Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, I guess on time would be nice, but actually getting a budget is the new threshold that we run across this year. We could work our way back to on time. Yeah, and, you know, people are still negotiating. There was some reporting this week that, you know, the negotiations had been foundering a little bit on, you know, this fight over just, you know, can we agree how much money we have to spend? Even though the governor's office and the nonpartisan legislative budget office were really not that far apart. I mean, it was a rounding error how far apart they are. But, you know, that was part of the debate. There's also a lot of consternation over money that the state is short in the current budget year. And the administration was really pushing to have this supplemental spending bill for the current budget year. But there was also reporting this week that, you know, this working group of legislators may actually be making some progress. Ultimately, this is, you know, a political calculation. I think people are just trying to figure out, you know, what does the governor want to do? Does he want to be able to say, I vetoed this budget because the Democrats want to spend out of control? Or does he want to be able to say, I work with Democrats and pass this budget? And I think, you know, everybody is sort of trying to anticipate 12 chess moves ahead what the other side is doing here. Meanwhile, the clock is running out. We have now fewer than 3 weeks left in the legislative session, which, you know, we're the reason the May 31st deadline is important is then you only need simple majorities to pass the budget. After that point, in order to get it to take effect on time, you would need super majorities. Of course, if the governor does end up vetoing the budget, you would need a super majority to override him anyway. So
we talked about revenue estimates, and Charlie, I think to the people listening, they would say, well, yes, I'd like to know how much money I've got to spend every month. Seems to make sense. Is this really a big issue?
Well, I guess in the eyes of the Republicans this year it is. Never was in the past. It was basically we figured out what we wanted to do and we figured out how to pay for it. Sometimes we raise taxes, and I'm going back and I'm dating myself. As everybody knows, I'm ancient, but going back to when Richard Ogilvie proposed an income tax. He said we want to spend more money for public schools, and to do that we have to have an income tax. And so, for example, the very last time that we did a revenue estimate was in the spring of 2014, and the initial estimate set out a figure of being available of roughly $34.5 billion. That was adopted basically by the beginning of March. Both chambers had agreed, this is how much we're going to have to spend. Well, when the budget was finally put together on the last day of the session, or I guess the day before the last, the 30th of May in 2014, a new revenue estimate was adopted that showed we're going to have almost $900 million more than we thought a couple months ago. And how did we do that? We just added $650 million that we were going to borrow from other funds, and we jacked the revenue estimates for the income tax by $200 million or so. So the revenue estimate is not set in stone. And if I were advising these guys, I'd say just go ahead and do a revenue estimate. It doesn't mean anything anyway. At the end of the day,
well, that seems not set in stone. It's not even set in paper, apparently.
But that does seem to get to the heart of what some people say is the problem with Illinois when it comes to budgeting, is that not paying attention to the bottom line.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's entirely true. The difficulty this time around is that the governor proposed a budget that includes making significant savings, if you will, by a couple of items. One, shifting a bunch of pension costs away from the state to local school districts and universities. And the second is reducing the spending for group employee health insurance for state employees, basically by making state employees pay more. Now, that is sort of problematic, or both of those areas are problematic. And if he doesn't get either, then there's a hole of maybe $1.5 billion, $1.6 billion that you have to fill. So the problem for the budgeteers is to figure out how to fill that hole.
Well, this week also, the Civic Federation took a closer look, Brian, at the governor's budget plan, the one that was laid out a while back. And what were some of the findings there?
They did not take a favorable view of this. They think, as we've heard from a lot of Democrats, that some of the governor's proposals are not very likely to pass the legislature. You know, it counts on things, as Charlie mentioned, a couple of them, you know, $470 million from changing state employee health insurance. This has been in, I think, just about every budget proposal he's put forward since he became governor. And that's something that is being fought in a protracted legal battle with AFSCME, the big labor union, over their health insurance and their state contract. They've been without a contract for more than – or what, going on 3 years now, three, 4 years? You also have the sale of the Thompson Center, $240 million, which the legislature has not been willing to go along with. I talked to somebody recently who said, you know, it's generally considered a bad idea to base your, you know, your general spending on one-time revenue sources. But, you know, we've been selling the Thompson Center so much, maybe that's becoming a recurring revenue source since it seems to show up every year in the budget proposals. The bottom line, the Civic Federation proposed a number of things that are they're also not very likely to pass, I would say, you know, looking at taxing retirement income, things like that. But basically the overall assessment was that, that they were not pleased with the governor's budget proposal.
Well, I've got to ask, as far as the fact that at least there are meetings taking place, that is at least something that, honestly, we have not seen pretty much since Bruce Rauner first took office. Those seemed to break off, and then they weren't meeting for months at a time. I got to at least feel like they're sitting across the table and some ideas are being, you know, bandied about, and maybe at the end of the day they'll reach some type of compromise. At least you hope so, but at least this is a good sign, isn't it?
I suppose, although, you know, the people who come out of the leaders' meetings are not, you know, they're not singing hallelujah and holding hands and talking together. You know, usually the Democrats come out first, and the Republicans or legislative leaders are huddling with the governor in the back room and watching the news conference that the Democrats say so that they can come out and offer some counter spin to the Democrat spin. And, you know, we're also these working groups. I mean, you know, this may not be great, but the reality of Springfield is that big ticket items get solved at the top level. And that means the governor and the four tops, the Speaker Madigan and Senate President Cullerton and the Republican leaders in the House and Senate. And, you know, to have these working groups, you know, the House is up to, what, five or six different budget committees. The Senate has two budget committees. A general rule of thumb, and I think Rich Miller, the Capital Facts newsletter writer and blogger, wrote about this week, you know, the more people you have in a meeting, the less serious the effort seems to be at actually coming to a final deal. And I think that's a good rule of thumb when you're watching Springfield. So I would be eager to see more tighter group meetings than, you know, just having, you know, opening it up for 20 plus legislators in a room.
And Charlie, it wasn't always done that way either. It was a little bit more of the people at the top making the final call on a lot of this.
Well, the way it used to work, and again, this goes back, you know, 20 years, it used to be that each caucus would have somebody who was their budget expert. Those four people would get together with staff, and they kind of outline, here's the difficulty, here's what we need to fund, here's the revenue available, here's how we might solve it. And on really big issues, for example, well, should we increase the gasoline tax to pay for a road program? Those types of issues, the actual decision would be kicked upstairs to the governor and the four legislative leaders. Back in the day when Jim Thompson was the governor, we used to talk about Big Jim and the Four Tops, like they were some rock group. But the grunt work, the spade work, the laying out the options and here's what we can do, and if we do this, this is what will happen, and so on. All that was done at a lower level, and then basically the choices were presented to the leadership, to the Republican and Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate, and to the governor. And they were the ones who actually cut the deal.
All right, well, we've got a couple of weeks left here in the month of May. We'll see what happens as we go forward. Rachel Otwell, I want to bring you back in. You had a chance to report this week for NPR on a national level about something going on in Illinois when it comes to guns and how some counties are treating gun laws.
Right, so I drove down to Effingham County. Effingham is the county seat, and talked to a couple of people there who drafted a resolution that declares sanctuary status for firearms. Obviously, we're more used to hearing that terminology used when it comes to immigration. You know, I talked to the state's attorney whose idea it was to throw in the language about sanctuary status for firearms. He alluded to culture wars that this kind of illustrates. The resolution basically takes several pieces of gun-related legislation that have been proposed and says they would not adhere to it and that they will help the feds out. They said they would help the feds out when it comes to, they're not going to uphold any sort of sanctuary thing when it comes to immigration, but they're more concerned about the Second Amendment.
So is that just federal law or state law or any gun laws when we're talking about it? So that's the way they're viewing
this. They were addressing any state legislation, okay, saying it would not be constitutional and they won't stand for it.
Yeah, and there was some talk of this and a lot of applause at the iGold. That's the Illinois Gun Owner Lobby Day. They had more than 2,000 people came to Springfield a couple of weeks ago. And when somebody mentioned this on the dais, at the speaking portion of the program, there was raucous applause. So this is something that gets people excited, gets gun owners excited anyway. We have the Second Amendment. The courts have been pretty favorable to gun owners in recent years, and certainly the Republican Congress has been favorable to gun owners, and even in the Illinois legislature has not really been successful in passing some of the most onerous to gun owners proposals, such as banning what are classified in Illinois law as assault weapons, things like that. Those have not been able to pass. They did pass some legislation to raise the age for purchasing assault weapons. It's not clear what the governor is going to do with that yet. And they also tried to pass a bill to require state licenses of gun dealers, which the governor vetoed, and the legislature was not able to override him on that. That story is not done yet. We still have a few weeks of the legislative session. People are continuing to try to round up votes for these things. But gun owners feel every time there's a national tragedy and an outcry and talk of more restrictions on firearms, they feel besieged, and this is something that gives them optimism or hope or whatever you want to say.
Well, and one of the main things that came out of the story that I did was that in Illinois, you have such a divide when it comes to concerns of rural agricultural downstate southern Illinois counties with Chicago concerns about stemming the gun violence there. People I talked to in Effingham said, we all grow up with guns in the house. We have them for recreation, for hunting, for protection. We can't all be looped in together under the same accommodations that might need to be made for Chicago. Meanwhile, several counties have followed Effingham's lead. They've passed similar resolutions, and Effingham County told me that they've heard from states like New York, Oregon, Washington, from other local governments that also want to adopt the same sort of language.
And Charlie, you've talked about this before, but Rachel touched on it there. When we're talking guns, we're almost talking a different language upstate and downstate when you get into like the Chicago area to central or southern Illinois.
Yeah, I've mentioned several times, and this has been true, as long as I've been watching Illinois government and politics, which is a long time. In rural areas, as Rachel said, and in southern Illinois, central Illinois, western Illinois, firearms as seen as just a natural part of life. You go hunting, and as a matter of fact, there are people who will go out and get a couple deer, put them in the freezer, and that helps feed their family. So it's a totally different situation. I remember I had a nephew who worked for a school district in rural western Illinois for a while. And the first day of hunting season, deer hunting season, the school shut down. And so my nephew, who's from Naperville, asked, was that because the students won't show up? And the principal said, no, it's because the teachers won't show up either. Because that was such a holiday in the region. On the other hand, you look at Chicago, and every day there's a story about some little kid who is an innocent bystander who's wounded by people shooting at somebody else. Just the other day, it was a 15-year-old girl who was killed in the Englewood neighborhood. And so in Chicago, guns are something evil, and that carries over in the mindsets of the lawmakers representing those constituents And so you have this vast divide. As if I'm not mistaken, Rachel, you mentioned there are other counties that adopted it. I think the one furthest north is Iroquois County, which is south of Kankakee.
And they actually, from what I read, they did not use the sanctuary status language. They had a similar resolution that was the inspiration for Effingham County that threw in the sanctuary status language.
I would just like to say here, I mean, it's one thing to pass a resolution, you know, in your county and say, we're going to do this. It's another thing to actually carry it out. Local government is a creature of the state. I mean, the state doesn't have to recognize, you know, everything that local government does. And I think when the rubber meets the road, it would be fairly outrageous if, you know, a sworn public official refused to uphold state law. And I think that that would bring another level of scrutiny and an added dimension to this.
And potential state law at that.
Fair enough.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of lawyers could make a lot of money if this thing keeps going, too, on all sides. So
constitutional law, not the most lucrative part of the law, but yes.
Yeah, that's always true about anything.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's go to our notes from the field. And Rachel, let's go to you first.
So this week over in Delaware, there were efforts to pass a state ERA. They were one of the states that ratified, as all the northern states other than Illinois did. And what ended up seeming to be the snag along the way was language regarding abortion, an amendment saying that separation is not discrimination. They still were not successful in passing that statewide.
Charlie?
Well, we've been talking about the state's sorry financial situation, and the foundation that helps support the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum here in town has a loan that's coming due next fall, a year from now. Well, I guess like 20 months from now. And they're short roughly $10 million, and they're not sure how they can find that money. They rely on private fundraising, and they were thinking about maybe having to auction off some Lincoln artifacts. And so the thought occurred to several people, myself among them, although this isn't original with me, wouldn't it be wonderful for the people of the state of Illinois if there were a moratorium declared by Pritzker and Rauner and, say, for 6 weeks or 2 months, the money that would have been spent on all this negative advertising instead would be donated to the foundation to remove the debt so that the Lincoln artifacts aren't threatened. I think that would be a real twofer for the people of the state of Illinois. You'd be spared this obnoxious propaganda, and we'd be preserving these artifacts.
We'll see how that works out. And Brian, let's go to you.
I was just going to pile on the bad budget news. There was a fascinating story out of the Peoria Journal-Star. Reporter Andy Kravitz wrote this week that a Peoria murder trial was delayed after the Illinois Department of Corrections said it was short of gas money. Western Correctional Center official sent an email apparently to the Peoria County State's Attorney's Office saying it could not bring an inmate who was going to be a witness in a murder trial because it was, quote, having difficulties with making fuel purchases at the current time. Of course, the Department of Corrections has asked for well over $400 million for supplemental budget, says it's had a hard time even buying stuff like toilet paper, apparently fuel as well.
All right, that's it for this week. I want to thank our panel, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Rachel Otwell. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.